I would invite you to Exodus 19, if you would. And let me remind you that we have landed here. No, that is not a pun. We have landed here at this chapter, and I have set this chapter aside by itself as a lesson because, it works out good for the calendar, but it's also, I think, an important chapter to pause and consider before we make our way into chapter 20. And in a sense, chapter 19 is a metaphor for this study. Chapter 19 represents the last chapter, which is narrative in this book. From this point on, from chapter 20 on, most of it will simply be the word of God as he speaks to his people. There will still be some historical material filtered in, but the vast majority of it is going to be God speaking. So this has been the journey that we have taken in consideration of the journey that they took to get to this particular place, a place where they would come and land and listen to the word of the Lord. So it's appropriate, I think, somewhat providential even, that we would land here, look at chapter 19, take a couple of weeks off, and then we'll start the second half of the book as God then begins to speak. So we'll be back the 15th of September for lesson 15. It has taken the Israelites 3 months to get to this place. You'll notice in the first verse it says, after the third new moon. So that's 3 months, or three 28-day periods, if you will. Rounding it off, it's 3 months. And that makes sense if you think about what's taking place or what has taken place in the previous four or five chapters. You're moving a million people, very conservative estimate of a million people, about 250 miles through a territory that is not very hospitable. Hold that thought for a moment. Trying to move a million people, a whole lot of cattle, and all of the other stuff that they possessed, that they took with them out of Egypt, certainly would have been an arduous task. We've had incidences where they have come to a place where there's no water, there's no food, obviously, in a wilderness place. Whatever they've been able to carry for them would not last long. Water wouldn't last very long, even less than the food would have last. They've had to deal with the environment. They've had to deal with enemies, the Amalekites, you remember, that came against them. And additionally, they're not really in a big hurry to get there. There's no reason to assume that these people are in a big rush to get to Sinai because they're not really sure where they're going. The obvious question that would have come to just about any of their minds is, why are we going in this direction? I thought Canaan was that way. Why are we going that way? And particularly, why are we going to a place where we're very sure ain't got nothing? And by the time we get to the end of it, it's but sea. So we're kind of going into a corner in a large sense. But that's exactly right. That's okay. So they weren't in a big hurry. God wasn't bringing them directly to the promised land. He was bringing them first and foremost to a place that he would meet with them. So they were unsure about this place. They were unsure about leaving Egypt. So they may have wandered somewhat aimlessly, waiting for a clear direction. And I say aimlessly only in the sense of a million people moving in a direction. Now, God knew where he was taking them, of course. He knew that purposely, and that's exactly why, you remember, a couple of weeks ago we talked about the fact that he actually turned them south and east rather than north and east, because he was not taking them directly to Canaan, he was taking them here. I said a minute ago that this is mountainous wilderness. It is barren and dry. It has little vegetation. It has little food. It has little natural water. And I'm convinced that the reason why God would bring them to such a place is because it's ideal. Not ideal for their survival, but ideal for them to come to a place where there would be nothing to distract them from their time meeting with God. It's a desolate place in which all of the, what would you call them, material temptations of life are removed. You don't really need to fight with your neighbor over the best plot of land to graze your cattle, because there ain't a great place. There's no reason to fight with your neighbor, because there ain't nothing. You don't need to worry about enemies, because there are none. Yes, the Amalekites came, but the Amalekites met with them north of here. And by the time they get this far south, the Amalekites aren't probably going to come down here. There's no reason to. In fact, the Amalekites may have been sitting at home and going, okay, so what in the world are they going down there for? Why is this Moses character leading a million people or more there? That doesn't seem to make any sense. They would have left them alone at that point. There'd be a few nomadic peoples living there, but they're certainly not going to be large enough to really bother the Israelites. So they're not going to have to worry about enemies. They're not going to have to worry about the material comforts of life. They're basically in a wilderness place specifically in order for them to focus on God, to bring them to a place of absolute barrenness where the only thing there is God. And obviously, of course, as we've talked about before, they would have to rely on God while they're there, specifically for their needs. But even that has already been taken care of, right? God has already provided for them water. They go out every morning to collect manna, and that's been going on for a while. And so it's not as though they have to go there and wait for God to give them what they need. He's already been giving them that on the journey. And so when they get there, that just simply continues. The idea is they come to a place where they have, I guess the best word to describe it would be a sanctuary. A sanctuary. A place where everything else is put aside in order for us, for the people, to focus on God. And by the way, in case you didn't know that, that's the reason why places of worship are called sanctuaries. They're not called sanctuaries because they're safe. Okay, that's the idea often. The original idea of sanctuary was a place away from everything else where we focus on one thing and one thing only, and that is God. So in reality, a sanctuary should be a place where we allow no outside influences to come at all. We should make sure that there's nothing there when we come to that sanctuary place, because all we're there to do is to meet with this God. That's where the Israelites were there. They were there to meet with this God. They were there for him to speak and them to listen and learn and understand what his requirements were, for them to build relationship with this God, for him to introduce himself for the first time now in a very long time. It's been more than 400 years since God last spoke to Jacob. And so this is an opportunity for them to come to a place and interact with their God, or better, for him to interact with them. Now, there's no way you can't see the parallels between this and Matthew 4, right? In Matthew 4, Jesus starts his public ministry by being driven into the wilderness. So he goes into a wilderness area. By the way, the wilderness area that he goes to is probably south into the Negev, although some have suggested that it's east towards, away from Capernaum. We don't really know which way. But either way, he goes to a desolate location, and he goes there for the exact same reason. He's sent there far away from everything else in order for him to be alone with God. Even the Son of God, the Eternal One, has to go and spend time with God before he goes into his public ministry. He needs to have a place of solitude, a place of prayer, a place of communion with his Father, and be prepared to go out and do the mission that he was set before him. We would just assume, wouldn't we, that, Jesus is the Son of God. He didn't need that. He could just take off from Nazareth and head off and do what he needs to do. But that's not what the Spirit of God does. The Spirit of God drives him into the wilderness first to say, I want you to go here and get prepared. And so he goes there for only 40 days. But nonetheless, he goes there for the specific purpose of spending time alone with God. He has limited access to food and water. Remember, at the end, he's hungry. He's been fasting during that period of time. And by the way, this is the function of fasting, okay? The biblical concept of restraining from food for a period of time. Remember, the Bible specifically speaks of fasting for the purpose of focusing on prayer. In other words, give up food, stop thinking about eating, and think about God. So use that energy that you would use for eating, put it into prayer and the word. That's the point of fasting. Again, like the Hebrews, Jesus in this case was tempted by the devil. Now, I would argue that this is similar here. The temptations that they were experiencing were the temptations to grumble over the fact that they didn't have water, they didn't have food, that they had to be forced out of their nice, comfortable homes in Egypt, which I don't remember them having. But nonetheless, that's how they think. And so they're in a sense, they're being tempted to these various material realities, just as Jesus was. And like the Hebrews, the purpose of this time alone was to strengthen him and prepare him for the journey that lay ahead. For Jesus, of course, the journey that lay ahead was 3 years of public ministry, culminating in his arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection. For the Hebrews, that journey included obedience to the law of God and a trip to the promised land, or a commitment to the law of God and a journey to the promised land. So there's parallels in these two journeys, a time of preparation. I mean, we could draw some other parallels. Moses spent 40 years in Midian in this particular area, getting ready to go and lead his people out of Egypt. Paul went back to Tarsus for 14 years before he started his public missionary work in order to prepare himself so that he could figure out how to understand this Jesus in light of the Old Testament, etc. So there's this sense in which preparation is an important time. It's an important part of what it means to take on ministry. I look at the 20 years that I spent as a software engineer as a time of preparation for this ministry. Didn't know it at the time. Had no clue of it at the time. In fact, would have never guessed when we were in BSF in the mid-90s that I would be doing this sort of thing. But it was preparation. It was training. It was prayer. It was learning how to deal with people. It was just a whole lot of things that you need to know as a minister that I was learning in those days. And I had all the material benefits, but nonetheless, it was a time of preparation. The Lord puts his people through preparation. And one final thought. Is it possible that the entirety of the Christian life is, in fact, a preparation for glory? You think? That our sanctification, the process of going through and being conformed more and more to the image of Christ as we are mortifying the flesh, rooting out sin, conquering temptation, growing in our understanding of the Word, growing in faith, is all leading us to that day of glory? I think so. Otherwise, why in the world would God leave us here in this state after we're saved? Wouldn't it be better just to take us to glory? No, he has a process in there. So the parallels are unmistakable. Our God uses opportunities of preparation for the work and for the glory that he lays in front of his people, whether those people be a million Hebrews or whether those people be just elect people like us or people serving him. Now, go to verses 4 and 5. Back to 3. Moses went up to God. The Lord called out to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel." And by the way, the parallelism in that statement. Okay, notice the parallelism. Say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel. Isn't that kind of redundant? It's designed to be redundant. What's it saying? Tell them this and get it right. Okay? All right, here's what he says. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." I wonder how many of them agreed with the idea that they're leaving Egypt and wandering through the wilderness to this point has been on eagle's wings. But nonetheless, that's how God puts it. I brought you here. I carried you to this place. "Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." Okay, now notice what God does here. God makes a promise to this ragtag group of people out in this wilderness place that they will be his treasured people. "You will be my treasured people among all peoples." Okay? "I'm going to set you into a unique place amongst all the people of the world." Yes, there are many other nations, by the way. You just encountered the Amalekites. They're a nation. You just came out of Egypt. They were a nation. There's other nations in the Canaanite territories that you're familiar with. In fact, some of you who are not Hebrew amongst this ragtag group, you belong to other nations as well. I'll tell you what. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you people a treasured nation. I'm going to make you special to me amongst all the peoples on the earth. You will be personally important to me. What that means is that I will be your God, you will be my people. I will fight for you, I will stand before you, I will give you my law, I will prosper you, and I will be present with you as a nation. That's unique amongst all the other peoples of the earth. No other nation on the planet has ever been able to claim such a thing. I'm sorry, guys, America has never received such promises, okay? God has only promised these things to one specific group of people in time. Now, just as a caveat, I would argue that he's made the same promise to the elect, which is a new nation of people that he is drawing to himself after this Christ. But nonetheless, as a nation, this is the only group of people, this is the only ethnic group of people on this entire planet that he has said, I will be your God, you will be my people. But the promise comes with a condition. Now, you should pause at this moment and go, what? Why a condition? And the reason you should pause and ask that is because God has already made this promise to Abraham without the condition. Remember? Back in Genesis 15, when God makes a promise to Abraham, he says, you are going to be my special one, and from you I'm going to draw a nation, and from you I'm going to draw them to this land, and this land is going to be theirs, and he doesn't put any conditions on it. Nothing in Abraham's obedience nullified that covenant, or could, because God never put a condition on him. He said, Abraham, if you obey my word, I will make this covenant with you. He never says that. He never says that to Israel. Jacob. He never says that to Isaac. He never says that to the 12 sons of Jacob. He never says that. This is the first time that God has added a condition to this covenant. Now, one could make the argument that the condition was implied, but it was never spoken. Here it is. And for the first time, it's spoken. Now, I'm one of those kinds that when I read the Bible in that way, I'm one of these that's constantly pausing and going, why? Okay, you should, by the way. Okay, wait a minute, wait. Why? Why would God add a condition here? In my mind, bizarre as it is, I'm thinking there must be a reason for God to add such a condition. Is it possible that this first promise of covenant, and you will notice, by the way, this comes before chapter 20, okay? That this first promise of covenant is based on a condition because God may have, in fact, been going, you don't want to say yes here. Take your time. Read the fine print first. Okay? Because up until now, it's been unconditional. Now, all of a sudden, it becomes conditional. My first reaction to that would be, whoa. Now, maybe I've got too much Jared Lyles in me as a lawyer type who would want to read the fine print and say, wait a minute, you're changing the terms here. So I want to speculate as to why you're changing the terms. The only conclusion that to me makes logical sense is that what God is actually doing is putting these people on the horns of a dilemma. And the horns of a dilemma is this: you can be my people if you will keep this covenant, but what you really ought to do, and this is where the dilemma comes in, what you really ought to do is step back and go, tell us what the terms are first, and then we'll decide whether we're going to say yes. Now, you will notice that they jump right in and say, all that the Lord says to us, we will do, right? Verse 8. Maybe so. Maybe the very reason that they're in such a place might be that they're willing to do that. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But here's what I do know. They jump into this covenant, okay? They jump into this covenant. Okay, and God has said this is what it's going to have. Now, so here's what happens. And this is open to some debate, so I'm willing to debate this with you if you want. But here's what happens. By agreeing so quickly to God's statement, I will be your people if you'll keep my covenant, they freeze themselves into this covenant. They leave themselves no wiggle room. Because they've said, we'll do it. Okay, we'll do it. We agree to it. Now they have, in essence, frozen themselves under the law as the only way to really have a relationship with this God. We know, of course, don't we, looking back on it now through 4,000 years of history, 3,400 years of history, that the people should have said, whoa, whoa, wait a minute, let me hear the conditions. Then God would give them the law, all of it, and then they would stop and go, but we can't do that. We don't have the ability to do that.
Or would they even recognize that they didn't have the ability?
Well, of course, we're looking at this in hindsight. Sure. They don't. Right, yeah. I understand that. Okay. But the infinite God of the universe knows what's going on here. Okay. I think what God is doing is forcing them into a place where they have no choice but to embrace the law, but that's what he wants. He wants them to embrace this law because it will become the foundation under which the gospel will then come. Because the only way for the gospel to be good news is if you've got bad news underneath it. And what's the bad news under the gospel? The bad news under the gospel is the law. Okay, in Reform circles, we talk about preaching law and gospel, and that those two things are opposed to one another. You preach law to point men to the fact that they're dead in their sins. They cannot do what God commands them to do. And then we turn around and give them the good news, which is that someone else has done it for them, that Christ has kept this law. And so in a sense, what God is doing in these few verses here, even before it gets to the point of telling them what the law is, he just gives them a very simple, what appears to be a very easy thing to do. Hey, I'll be your God, you be my people, just do what I tell you to do. They go, yeah, no problem. Maybe not. Now, let me just pause for a moment and put a big fat parenthesis right here. Is this the same thing that happens in the church when the pastor offers the gospel to people without telling them what the full requirements of that gospel are? And they rush down the aisle to receive it without ever really knowing what it is? The easy believism of the 20th century? Bonhoeffer noticed that when he came to the United States, he goes, all they're preaching there is easy believism, and there's a whole lot of people that have believed something, but they have no idea what they've gotten themselves into. And the fact is, they're going to get themselves out of it real fast when they do find out what it is. Okay? In other words, if you only preach a message that doesn't give the full detail of it, what is the natural inclination of human beings? Yeah, no problem. I want that. That sounds great. And then they get to read the fine print. And then they're, wait a minute. I'm supposed to, pick up a cross and carry it and abandon my hopes and dreams that I had for my life before in order to follow this Christ? I've got to mortify the flesh every day. I've got to grow in the grace and knowledge of this Christ and be conformed. That's not what I signed up for. I was told by the preacher, you just believe in this Jesus, pray this little prayer, and you go to heaven when you die. You know, talking about what we were talking about earlier. Is it not the parallel that the reason why there is, or will be in these coming days, so much apostasy is because of the fact that we haven't really preached the gospel in a way in which we've told people what it truly takes to embrace this Christ. We've sort of given them the old bait and switch. I don't think God's doing a bait and switch here, but he's putting them in a position of having to deal with this matter. And by the way, this is exactly why I stopped on 19, because when you get to 20, you get the details. Now you get the details of what it's going to take. And what you discover after about 6 or 7 chapters of details is, holy moly, how in the world are we going to do that and do it perfectly for the rest of our lives? Especially that part about be holy because I am holy. Okay, so he's putting them in a place where he's forcing their position, but I would argue that the picture that's being painted is a picture of truthfulness that must carry over into the New Testament. The totality of the picture must be painted. So I often say, you cannot understand the New Testament without understanding the Old. What is it that God is forcing? Now, there's some symbolism here that comes. You notice a couple of times it talks about a smoke that comes upon the mountain, right?
Not to interrupt, but so, yes. I mean, are you saying that theoretically, I understand everything's in God's plan, but theoretically, the people here could have been like, if they were paying attention, could have been like, we're already your people.
Uh-huh.
You made that promise a long time.
That's correct.
So we don't need, I mean...
Hey, wait a minute. You made a promise to Abraham that you were going to be our God. What's all this condition stuff all about now? Now, I think Jamie's absolutely right. They haven't got a clue.
400 years, though.
Correct. They didn't have a clue. That's what Jamie's point was, and he's absolutely right. But we're looking at it from a perspective from behind, looking back to it, okay? So we can see this. They weren't able to see it so much. So I'm not necessarily blaming them, per se, as being foolish. But at the same time, I am. A little. They're look, come on, how many times are these people going to wind up being in a place where they have to repent before God and they just go back to saying the same thing? Okay, all right, we failed, God, we promise we'll do it this time. Or we failed, we promise we'll do it this time. Or, you know, Judah's watching the 10 northern tribes be carted off into Assyria, and Judah's going, yes, yes, we'll do what we're supposed to do. I know our brothers couldn't do it, but we'll do it. Again and again and again and again and again. Okay, so I think this is the heart of human beings, unfortunately, but like it is what it is.
They got slick where they started changing the law.
Well,
they could get as close as they could.
Well, they would add to it in order to box themselves in the hopes that they would keep from getting there. Okay, a couple of symbolisms here. It says that there's a great cloud in verse 16, that comes down in the mountain. Also notice in verse 9, God says, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud. I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud. The thick cloud, by the way, is probably best interpreted as a severe darkness. You notice how it gets darker outside when you have a thick cloud overhead, right? Okay. The picture of a cloud is the idea not so much of a smoke or a mist or something, but more of a darkness that comes over this place. Now, this is the reason I bring this up is because it's... I don't think many of us really think about God as darkness. Okay, we think about God as light, right? Our natural tendency is to think of his glory as being an unapproachable light. But the Bible also speaks of God as darkness, a darkness that comes. And the darkness represents the holiness of God. It represents that sense of him being so different from everything else, that everything else scatters from him, including even light itself. It's kind of like the black hole idea, right? It's the gravity so strong that nothing can escape, even light, so it becomes a void in space where you really can't even see into it because those things that would come to us to help you to see it don't come to us. They go in the opposite direction. That's the idea here. A force of God, his holiness, so great that it proceeds with darkness. There's one of the hymns, I don't remember which one it is, but it talks about God coming in darkness. And that's a picture of holiness. It's a picture of God being so utterly unique and so utterly separate and different that his very essence is one not of light, but of darkness. So those concepts seem to be contradictory, but they're really not from the metaphor perspective. Okay, so this thick cloud represents the presence of God in a visible and personal and audible and, I would dare say, tangible sort of way. God comes to the people so they can hear him and see him and know that he is there. Remember, the Bible says no one has ever seen God. Right? No one's ever seen God. The only reason we see God is because he became incarnate. And the Spirit manifests himself in certain ways in creation, but nobody's really seen God. Those tongues are not really God per se. They're tongues of fire. They represent the Spirit who is there. So we see God in Christ, but no one has ever seen God. So you have this picture of God making himself visible, tangible, real, coming to them. And he comes to them in this way. And remember, he says that this is designed so that people might believe Moses. They might believe you, God says, forever.
They've been following this cloud for a long time. This one's different, right?
This one's a different kind of cloud. The cloud that was before was more of a visible manifestation of a guide of some sort. It doesn't give us any details, but some way that they could see him in a distance and follow him. This is a shroud coming over the mountain, settling upon the mountain in such a way that it would clearly be something different. The people would look and go, well, this is something else. This is something different. The absence of sin, of course, becomes the same idea. Okay, so God wants the people to know that he has come, and he wants the people, and specifically, he wants the people to know that when Moses speaks, he speaks for God. So God says, I want you, Moses, to come to me when I come with this cloud. See what he says? He says, behold, I'm coming to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe you forever. So God is going to speak to Moses from this darkness. Moses is going to hear the word of God, and then Moses is going to go down, and he's going to be the human spokesperson for God. God is going to use, what's the word here? A means to communicate. Could God have simply implanted his word into the minds and hearts of the million people at the foot of the mountain?
Sure.
Or could he have just bellowed it out in some big voice booming from the mountain?
Sure.
Certainly, but he chose not to. He chose instead to use a human intermediary. See it? He's choosing to use Moses to be his spokesman. And we might question the wisdom of that and say, well, why would God do that? Why didn't he just speak himself? I mean, wouldn't the people believe him better if he spoke his own voice? I mean, if God spoke in a big thundering voice from the mountain, wouldn't they believe him? Well, look how the people responded. They were afraid of that, and rightly so. And so God decides, I'm going to use this mediation of a human to speak through. Now, I don't have to go way out on the limb here to make a parallel, do I? In that in Christ, God has come to speak to us through a human intermediary. Okay, so this is a similar picture, which is why Moses is often pictured as a precursor or foreshadowing of the Christ. He's coming to speak for God. The difference, of course, is that Moses is just some guy. Jesus is the very Son of God himself, who doesn't come to speak for God, comes to speak as God. That's the difference. But nonetheless, that doesn't diminish Moses' authority. No, because God says, I'm going to speak through you, and they're going to believe you. And not just tomorrow. They're going to believe you forever. See what he says? He says forever. He doesn't say just tomorrow. He says forever. Which means that the people of Israel are going to believe the words of Moses now through time. All the way to the days of Christ. Every time the Pharisees would appeal to the law, what did they say? Remember? Moses said to us. Right? Sometimes they said the law says to us, but very often they said Moses says to us. So they put it in his mouth. And sometimes Jesus did the same thing, right? Moses said to you that you ought to do this, but I tell you that you ought to do something. So Jesus would put himself in a higher position than Moses, which is one of the reasons that the Pharisees got jacked up about him, because he would have the audacity to do that, to actually make himself greater than Moses and speaking for Moses. So God's coming and he's going to speak. So this big cloud comes down, which leads to a second symbolism, and that is that they were prohibited from touching the mountain. Verse 12, you shall set limits for the people all around, saying, do not go up to the mountains, take care, or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. He shouldn't be touched when he does so, but he will be stoned or shot. In other words, what he has touched has infected him, therefore you don't touch it either. Okay? In a sense, the holiness has transferred itself to God, and so I don't want you touching it. So therefore, take him out of the camp, stone him to death, or shoot him with an arrow, or whatever you got to do, and then that's it. Okay? But it's all symbolic. It's all symbolic. I mean, as I mentioned last week when we were doing the question, a couple weeks ago when we were doing the questions, where exactly is the boundary line around a mountain? Have you ever been to the foot of a mountain and said, okay, here's the mountain, starts right here? Because usually the slope is quite gradual before it begins to go up dramatically. So you're kind of up, you could be 5 miles away from the edge of it and still feel that upward climb. So the limits are simply artificial. Just draw a boundary around this mountain at the best spot you can and put that there, and then the people cannot cross that boundary. God doesn't tell them where the boundary line is. He just says, just draw the boundaries around it. Okay. Again, why? Because it's symbolic. It's not some literal sense that that stone is holy and that one is not. But rather, it's the sense in which the people recognize this place is where God is residing. In fact, at the end of the chapter, it says, God says in verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also, let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, this is his retort, he says, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. We've already drawn boundaries. We know where they are. We've already established them. So in other words, Moses is saying, look, we already drew boundaries around it, so I'm not worried about the people rushing. We've already put that in place. I think all that's just to make sure that the people understand what this is all about. I think it's all about, okay. So the picture is of a darkness coming down across the mountain and boundaries being set around it in order to send a message to the people of Israel, this million or more people that are now camped around this mountain. You have come into the presence of a God uniquely different from anything you can imagine. All of the gods that you knew in Egypt, they were all easily identifiable. You knew where they were. You knew what they were. You knew they were fictions. But nonetheless, there they were. They were statues or obelisks or something to that effect. You had some idea. This is different. This is the creator of heaven and earth. This is the one true and living God. This is a God who actually has breath. This is a God who is real and living. And this is a God who is utterly distinct, different, transcendent, greater than anything that you can imagine. So you're going to come to a mountain, not just a statue, a mountain, and a great darkness is going to descend upon this mountain. It's going to be palpable, and there's going to be very clear boundaries drawn around this place that you are not allowed to go beyond, because you will be going quite literally into the presence of this holiness. See what he's doing? He's establishing a relationship. These are the first and beginning ideas of a relationship with God. God first says, here's who I am. I'm not like anything you can imagine. I'm not like anything that you've encountered before. So this people isn't just encountering some God that's sending a message. No, this is a God who's actually coming down to meet them. But in order for a transcendent God who created the heavens and the earth to come to a people, he must establish how he comes, which is what he does. But there's a reverse to this as well. If you look at verses 10, 11, 13, 15, you will see that there were certain regulations beyond even this that God had established for the people, right? He says in verse 10, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. Okay, so he says, I want you to do something else too. Not only am I going to come down and introduce myself to you, but you are going to introduce yourself to me. Now, obviously, all of this is symbolic, but nonetheless, the picture is this. God comes down. How do the people come to him? They need to be prepared to say, we recognize who this God is, and so we're going to come in the right attire, and we're going to come in the right fashion to the foot of this God and stand before this God. We're going to do that. Now, that's why he says consecrate them. Consecrate means to set them aside. Okay, it's the word. In the Hebrew and in the Greek, the word for consecrate has a similar root as the word holy. Set aside, set apart. We use the word saint today as a word that comes out of the same root as this idea. Set apart unto something. When the priest would consecrate a vessel, they would pray over the vessel, anoint it with oil, and set it aside. Okay, this vessel doesn't get used for anything but worship of God. Same thing for you people. You are now set aside to be nothing more than those who will come into the presence of this God. So they were to consecrate themselves, and they were to do so specifically by washing their garments. Anybody catch the irony there? What do you wash your garments in a wilderness? What do you wash your garments in the wilderness? There ain't a lot of water around here. We know that, right? Because Moses had to go and deal with a rock in order to get some water out of it. And we don't not sure exactly how the people are getting water at this point, but probably similar to the way that Moses had provided for him some sort of supernatural way in which water was coming to them. They would have to take their garments and go and wash them in their drinking water. Sacrificing their drinking water for this consecration. There's a sense in which the people are being asked to do something fantastic in order to come before this God. It's self-sacrificial, if you will. You've got to be willing to take your garments, wash them, and then put them on, and then come to me. And the fact of the matter is the people traveling through this wilderness would have been stinky, they would have been dirty, they're animal keepers anyways, which is why the Egyptians despised them, because they were dirty people, because they were, you know, animal keepers and Semites, and so they were, yeah, it wouldn't have smelled pretty. So what do? You take your water and use it to wash your garments. Do that on the first day and the second day, because it's on the third day that I'm going to come down to visit you. It's on the third day that I'm going to come down. For on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set limits around the people. Okay, and we've talked about that before. So Moses went down, verse 14, and he consecrated the people, and they washed their garments, and he said to the people, be ready for the third day. And he adds a restriction. I don't see God adding that restriction, but I do see Moses adding it. And it's possible it came from God, but I don't see anything prior to that that says it came from God. So we can debate whether it came from God or whether it didn't. But either way, Moses adds a restriction. Don't go near a woman. I want you to restrain yourself not only from that which would get you dirty, but I want you also to restrain from the physical activity of being with a woman. Now, of course, he's speaking to the men, obviously, but that would also apply to the women as well, because if the men don't show up, well, the women aren't going to do anything either, right? Okay, so in other words, consecrate yourself by staying away from the kinds of things that would make you quote-unquote dirty, okay? Quote-unquote dirty. Again, notice the sacrifice of this. Okay, none of that kind of activity. Use your water to wash your garments, make yourself clean, prepare yourself to stand before God in this place. So I think that those things are designed to be the way in which the people presented themselves to God. God says, here, I'm going to present myself as darkness and a limited place. You come to me as the people that are washed. You have spent the last 3 days preparing for this, right? You're coming now on the third day, so you're ready. You know what's about to take place, a serious business. I'm going to meet with you. I'm going to come and meet with you. Again, notice the picture of this. This is not a picture of God saying, yeah, let's just have a cup of coffee on a Friday afternoon. I'll just be your friend. Let's come down and have a conversation. No, this is a picture of a distinction between a transcendent infinite God and a bunch of creatures made out of dust. And they have to come together. And this might be a stretch, so you might debate me on this one. But you remember when God first created the human race, and he said, let us create them male and female from the dust of the ground. And remember we talked about the fact that being male and female, and the side effect of that was the primary purpose of that, was, of course, procreation. And what is the act of procreation? Sex. Okay. God comes, Moses comes to the people and says, you need to be ready to go meet with God, even to the very core of what you are. You are male or female. You are creatures that are sexual by nature, because that's the way God created you. You need to think through all of that as you approach this God. He's your creator, so you come as creature and recognize that you're creature. Don't come thinking that you're God. And don't come to this mountain thinking that you get to tell God what to do. Or you get to decide how this is going to go. No. This is God saying, these are my terms. I'm the creator. You're just dust. Male and female dust you are. But nonetheless, you're dust. And that's an important reality. One I wish we could recapture in the church a bit more. of this idea of who is God? God's not our friend, our buddy, our pal. He's not some deity that we sort of take for granted. No, no, we're talking about the infinite God of the universe, who is so far above our imaginations, we can't even begin to fathom who he is. Being a, you know, an amateur astronomy buff, I enjoy, you know, talking about the various things that you can see in the universe today. I just cannot fathom a God that's bigger than what's out there. It's beyond my imagination, because human beings cannot even fathom what they can see through the Hubble telescope at this point. It's become so beyond our imagination. You know, when I was growing up, there were 23 known galaxies. Today, there are billions of galaxies. Okay. In other words, we come to this God. We don't come to this God on our terms. We come on his terms. And so this is what we need to recapture in the church: a higher view of God, a high view of God, an ultimate view of God. That's, I think, what God is doing here. We're going to have a relationship, that's right. But let's make sure that you understand the terms of that relationship. I'm God. You're not. You're just the creature. I'm the sovereign one of heaven and earth. You're putty in my hand. You're clay. You're dust in my hands. I will do with you as I will. And the people come and say, okay, we get it. There's a picture being painted in this chapter. So, let's go back to verse 6. Remember the promise. Okay. You're going to be my treasured people among, possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. That's a duh. All right? And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay. You're going to be set aside, but you're going to be a kingdom of priests. Priests act as go-betweens between God and men. Now, there's going to be some priestly stuff going on here later in this chapter. If you look at, let's see, I've got to find it again. It's in verse 22. Also, let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves. Even though the Levitical priesthood has not yet been established in Israel at this point, there's still an idea of priests. Every religion on this planet, by the way, has had some idea of priests, some go-between of some sort. Even the Far Eastern religions have some of this idea of something or someone that goes between us and a deity or something to that effect. So it's always been around. So in this case, God says, that's built into you as humans, because you do recognize that I am holy and transcendent and other, and you're not just going to walk into my throne room. You already know that in your core of cores. So you've already had this idea. But I'm going to turn you as a nation into a nation of priests. I'm going to turn you into a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay, that word holy meaning separate, unique, but I think it's connected to the priesthood in that verse. I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, meaning you're going to be a people who are, if you will, a singular priest. Although you're a million people, you're going to be a priest. You're going to act as a go-between between me and all the rest of the world. All of my revelation as God is going to come through you to the world, and the rest of the world is going to come to me through you. Now, that makes sense as the history of Israel unfolds, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is the only nation that received the law, so all the other nations of the world received the law, the moral code, if you will, through the Israelites. It is through this nation, of course, that the Christ would eventually come, through which God would bring himself to man, and all of humanity would be brought to God, or the elect would be brought to God, and so forth. So the nation of Israel becomes this go-between between God on this side and humanity on this side. So God said, I'm going to make you a special group of people who are literally going to be my conduit into the world. It's going to be through you that I'm going to bring all of my revelation to the world. Okay? That makes sense, right? Okay. Now, Peter picks up on this in 1 Peter 2 when he talks about us being a royal priesthood. Now, in this case, he says a royal priesthood. He doesn't say a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But the concepts are so very much similar that you can't really miss it. The royalty and priesthood technically doesn't go together. Remember, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The priests were never the kings were never the priests. Those were two distinct roles in Israel. Kings were kings, priests were priests. And when kings tried to be priests, they got themselves into trouble. And when priests tried to be kings, they got themselves into trouble. A priest could become a kingmaker like Samuel, but that didn't make him a king. It made him a kingmaker, but it didn't make him a king. And only the only reason he was a kingmaker was God told him where to go and who to anoint. So there's a distinction. But in the New Testament, Peter brings these two ideas together to become a royal priesthood, a group of people who will now stand in the place of the King of Kings in order to act as his priest. So the church, the body of Christ in the world, becomes the conduit through which Christ comes to the world. I mean, how else does Christ come to the world except through us? Through the preaching of the word, through the word that's given to the church, which is the pillar and foundation of the truth. It comes through the church, through the elect people to the world. The church becomes the conduit through this. Okay, so what God is doing here is he is, in a way, sort of foreshadowing what will come eventually when another nation, the elect, are drawn together in the church. Now, we can argue all day about replacement theology in terms of whether the church replaces Israel or not, and I don't want to get into that discussion, but what goes on here is the idea that there's a clear foreshadowing of the idea that God uses the means of priests to move his grace into the world. This time, it's going to be the Israelites. In the future, it's going to be the church. Christ will anoint a people to himself to be priests, just as God has anointed himself a people to be priests. Question?
You answered what I was going to ask you.
Okay.
I asked you when you went on to the royal priesthood. I said, well, that means telling everybody that's an Israelite to be a pastor.
Correct. Every Israelite is going to be a priest.
Right, but you changed it when you went into
Correct. And it becomes a royal priesthood because it's representing a king.
That's what I was thinking.
From the king will flow. Yeah, this. Okay. The reason I brought that up and made the comparison here is because the language that God uses in verse 6 is very similar to the language that Peter uses in 1 Peter 2. And so the parallel is unmistakable. God is establishing a people to be a set of priests in both cases. Okay. Now, something interesting here that I don't think we really talked about too much a couple of weeks ago, but it says in verse 19, the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. All right. In verse 16, it says, on the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain. Okay, we talked about that. But it also says there was a very loud trumpet blast. Who blew the trumpet? Where's this trumpet coming from? Was there a certain group of Israelites that had all been given trumpets and told to go stand around the mountain and blow the trumpet? I'm sorry, I've searched this text from top to bottom. I've never seen that. I've never seen God say, establish a group of trumpeters to sound the trumpet. And the fact is, according to this, the trumpet gets louder and louder. Where is it coming from? I am convinced that it's coming from heaven. That is a trumpet blast being sounded by an angel, as we will see again in the New Testament, right? When the trump sounds and the angel makes the announcement that the Christ is coming, I think this is a trumpet blast from heaven. And the trumpet blast, you remember, represents the call of God. And what is it a call to? It is a call, it is an announcement to judgment. It is always a call to judgment.
Revelation.
Just like in Revelation, it's a call to the judgment. The trumpet will sound, Christ will descend, and all the nations of the world will be drawn to the foot of the great white throne, and Jesus will carry out his work of analyzing every single human being, right? Okay, so it's a trumpet, I think. I think this is a supernatural trumpet sounding from heaven through the darkness, from the mountain, so that the people hear it. By the way, if you were standing at the foot of this mountain, how would you feel right about now? Would you be excited?
Terrified.
You'd be terrified. Well, I would hope he would be, because the picture, you know, exactly right. If I touch this thing, I'm going to die, so I'm backing off. But nonetheless, the trumpet sounds, this great darkness falls upon the mountain. Thunder and lightning is coming as God is speaking in thunder and lightning to the people, right? So they don't really hear his voice, but they hear his voice, quote unquote, okay? It's an announcement of judgment. Now, why is this an announcement of judgment? I mean, there's no judgment going on here in the sense of we think of judgment, right? Where God says, well, let me weigh your deeds and see how you do. But yet, at the same time, that's exactly what God is going to do, isn't he? Didn't he just say a moment ago, I will be your God if you will do these things? It's a judgment in the sense of God weighing whether or not they really will do what he said he wants them to do. It is a judgment. It is a judgment upon God to come and to say, I'm going to judge you as my people. Now, the judgment is not a judgment of, okay, get away from me. It's quite the opposite. It's a judgment of, you are mine. Now, you belong to me. I'm going to make you my people, and I'm going to use you as a royal priesthood. And this trumpet blast announces that this transaction is taking place, that these people are being brought to God, and God is judging them. Not in the negative sense of the word, but in the positive sense of the word, the positive sense of, you belong to me.
Making it real.
Making it real. It's a judgment of love, if you will.
A judgment of love, but yeah. It was their announcement of war as well.
It was also their announcement of war, but isn't that a judgment too?
Yeah.
Doesn't God judge through war? People die. Judgment happens. Okay. So in other words, this idea is that he is being called into the presence, they are being called in the presence of God, so he can judge them by establishing his law in them. They will quite literally become a people through which God will determine righteousness and unrighteousness. Did you catch that? It will be through these people that God will determine the difference between righteousness and unrighteousness. Unrighteousness is defined as not keeping what God has commanded. Righteousness is defined as keeping what God has commanded. And so the very essence of judgment is, have you done what I have commanded you to do? Remember, we talked about this, I think I talked about this from the pulpit, right? What is judgment? Judgment is God looking at all of the deeds of our lives, because it says every single time in the New Testament, you will be judged for what you have done. It doesn't say you'll have to be judged for what you believed. It says you'll be judged for what you have done. But what you have done will demonstrate something. It will demonstrate who you are. Righteous or unrighteous. And so God is literally saying to the world, I am going to use this people as the instrument of determining the difference between who is righteous and who is unrighteous. I'm establishing the category of righteous and unrighteous over all the earth. That's what the law will do. In fact, I think that's the reason why God starts with the Ten Commandments. Because what's the most fundamental definition of righteousness? The moral code, established in the very nature of human beings. In fact, you could make a pretty good argument that everybody already knew these things in the Ten Commandments, right? They were built into us at creation because they're part of the very nature of God himself. They're part of the imago Dei within us. We already know you shouldn't kill somebody. Do we have to be told? So what is God doing? God is saying, I'm establishing the difference between righteousness and unrighteousness in order to demonstrate that there's only one who is righteous. Him. These million people at the foot are only going to prove one thing. They are not. And they never could be. Even if they had said to God, I want to wait for the fine print before I make a conclusion. Now, if they had done that, and let's just speculate, if they had done that, they might come to the end of the law and go, you've said that's what unrighteousness is? We're pretty much unrighteous here by that definition. We're pretty much unrighteous here. So what does the law do? It drives the people away from law to mercy. But it has to establish a foundation for it. The foundation is God himself. So God comes down on this mountain in this great darkness, a great trumpet sounds, and the great trumpet says, I am making a judgment. I am establishing in all the earth what is righteous and what is unrighteous. I'm going to do so through you, because you are the people I have drawn to this place, so you're going to be the instrument, the means through which I'm going to bring the definition of righteousness and unrighteousness into the world. Are you game? I don't know about you, but if I'd had 2,000 years of church history behind me, I'd have been running in the other direction as fast as I could go. It's like, I know what I be. I don't need God to tell me. I know. But notice what he's doing. He's establishing righteousness and unrighteousness so that all the earth will stand before him and all mouths will be closed. Nobody gets to define what those terms mean except God. And again, it comes from his very nature. In Hebrews 12, we'll close with this. In Hebrews 12, in verses 18 to 24, it says, for you have not come. Now, this is the writer writing to a set of Jewish believers at this point. Okay, so they believe in this Jesus. Okay, he says, for you believers have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages would be spoken to them. Okay, notice the writer's describing Sinai. No doubt of it. No doubt of it at all. And every Jewish reader of this book would have understood exactly what the author meant. We remember that. We remember when our forefathers stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and a darkness came down and God established and a trumpet sounded and all this kind of thing. Okay, you have not come to that. You, believer, you've not come to that. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But, verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The difference between the two pictures that is painted here is a picture of doom and gloom and destruction and judgment versus a grand party. A festal gathering is a party. It is a massive celebration of God and what he has done. That's the difference. What he says is you have come to something entirely different than what they came to. They came to doom and gloom and despair. They came to a place where they stood there and they were terrified, and rightly so, because they were looking into the face of holiness, which they were not. God had come down and defined what righteousness was, which they were not, and they knew it. He had come to them in this way and scared the living daylights out of them. But that's not what you've come to. You've come to something entirely different. God has entered into his world and made a different approach to the elect than he made with the people of Israel. In a sense, you could say that when God came down on that mountain, he came down in a way that indicated what was to come. And what was to come was utter failure on the part of the people standing at the foot of that mountain. Right? Utter failure. Everyone who attempts to keep the law is condemned. In fact, the writer speaks of that earlier in this book. You cannot solve sin problems with sacrificial goats. There is no solution. Those people were doomed as they stood at the foot of that mountain. But we don't go to a place of doom. We go into the presence of God himself. We go before this Christ, whose blood is better than Abel's. It goes even further back than Abraham. He goes all the way back to Abel, to the righteous one at the beginning. Remember, Abel is pictured as the righteous one between Cain and Abel, the two children of Adam and Eve, who represented the contrast between righteousness and unrighteousness at the very foundation of the earth. And unrighteousness killed righteousness because it demonstrated what humanity had become. And so this blood of Abel is so much greater because it's a picture of this Christ who is the righteous one, who comes in the name of Abel, whose blood is perfect, who offers a perfect sacrifice, and a festal gathering of angels who are celebrating. The trump that sounds is not a trump of judgment. The trump that sounds is a trump of acceptance. Come! You are welcome now into the presence of God. That's the difference between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion. Mount Sinai is a place of doom and gloom and destruction and death. Mount Zion is a place of life and joy in the presence of God. The very essence of all that this Christ has accomplished for us is the difference. See that? The writer here understood exactly what Exodus 19 is talking about. And by the way, all of what I've just said before about the doom and gloom and the trumpet and all this stuff is based on the interpretation of these verses here. The writer of Hebrews knew it. He said, I know what those people experienced. They experienced fear, condemnation, destruction. We don't. And what's his point? Stop thinking like them. Stop thinking like them. Stop thinking, as a bunch of Jews, that you can still satisfy God by your sacrifices and your keeping of the law and your festivals and your feasts and all these things. They don't work. They never have. Stop thinking like that. You haven't come to that mountain. You've come to a very different place. You've come to Christ. So you'll notice that Exodus 19 isn't a throwaway chapter. Sorry. I would argue that Exodus 19 is an extraordinarily important chapter in establishing these people. They camp at the foot of Mount Sinai, but why are they there? Are they there because their relationship with God is going to be a gloriously beautiful, bright relationship with Him? Exactly the opposite is being painted. It is a picture of unrighteousness being defined. But that is all a foreshadowing of what will eventually come in the Christ and Mount Zion. So, that's another reason to camp, if you will, pardon my pun, at chapter 19.
Speak to us yourself, and we will listen and talk to Moses.
But not have to speak to us. You speak to us, Moses. Don't let God speak to us. So, take away that as you then enter into the Ten Commandments. Now, I realize I painted a picture of doom and gloom here about the Ten Commandments. But we will talk about the positive aspects of the law as well as we go through this, especially as that is fulfilled in Christ. So we will not look to the law as God gives it as that which we keep in order to be satisfied. We will look at the value of the law in terms of what Christ has accomplished for us so that we are not those keeping it. So we will still see its value, though. Okay, so we're not going to be antinomians. We're going to look at the law, see its value, recognize its value, but recognize its completion in Christ, not in ourselves. Okay? So, we'll see you on the 15th. Come back on the 15th and we'll get started. The questions are up there for you for that time. Oh, and by the way, don't turn the paper over going, where's the rest of the questions? Because I am not dealing with every one of the commandments equally. Okay? Yeah, so, I am going to skip over a few. That's okay. I think you pretty much figured out what it means. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. I don't really need to deal with that.